Hi, Dave Emmer here. This is For the Record program number 1026, the so-called Arab Spring Revisited Part 2. This is being recorded on October 2nd of the year 2018. We are going to be revisiting, again, the so-called Arab Spring. I call it the Muslim Brotherhood Spring. And we're going to be looking at some things that will track backward in historical time and also forward and reflect on the present. In our last several shows, we have noted that although there is a temporary diplomatic hiatus in the combat in Syria, the last major stronghold of jihadist strength is Idlib, that's capital I-B-L-I-B as in boy province, in Syria. Those jihadists are basically al-Qaeda, and the Idlib province is heavily populated, and in the event of an anticipated Syrian army military offensive backed by Russian air support, there is almost the certainty of high civilian casualties, and the U.S. and Britain and France and also Germany have warned that if there is a chemical attack, if Assad uses chemical weapons, they will intervene. In the past, there have been some chemical weapons attacks that almost certainly appear to have been provocations. Some of the Islamist forces in Syria do have chemical weapons capabilities, perhaps from some of the old weapons that were transferred by Saddam Hussein prior to his ouster in the Iraq War, and also perhaps from the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, who also had some chemical weapons capabilities. I have discussed the possibility of a flashpoint between Russian and American militaries in the event that there is a chemical weapons provocation. For the time being, there has been a, not exactly a demilitarized zone, but a truce zone that has been established with some of the, between Syrian army forces and the jihadists in Syria. So for the time being, that is all on hold. However, we are delving back into the so-called Arab Spring in order to take a look at how the Arab Spring led to the resurrection of al-Qaeda. We look at that in For the Record 1024 and 1025 using a relatively mainstream article from Bruce Hoffman of the Council on Foreign Relations. And we have also taken a look at how the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist organization that was allied with the Axis in World War II, and like so many fascist organizations, then jumped to elements of Western intelligence in the post-war period for use against communists, socialists, the former Soviet Union, and others. The Muslim Brotherhood, and even beyond its utility as proxy warriors or labor enforcers in the Arab and Muslim world, the Muslim Brotherhood has a corporatist and laissez-faire economic doctrine that has endeared it to the transnational corporate community. We're going to talk more about that in this program. We, in our last program, went into the fact that Ibn Khaldun, that's IBM, second name, capital K-H-A-L-D-U-N, is viewed by the World Bank as the first advocate of privatization. He is the primary economic theoretician that is held up as exemplary by the Muslim Brotherhood. And to give you an idea of the resonance of Ibn Khaldun with the Western transnational and right-wing corporate community, that last is redundant, Ronald Reagan in explaining or attempting to explain how his supply-side economics would work, cited Ibn Khaldun as an example, as someone whose theoretical pronouncements would reinforce Ronald Reagan's supply-side economics. We're going to go back into that in this program. However, in this broadcast, we are going to take a look at how Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood are inextricably linked. We've spoken about that before, and in this program, we are going to take a look not only at the telephonic and political operational networking between the Muslim Brotherhood President of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, and Mohammed al-Zawahiri, the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda activist, and the imprisoned, at least initially, brother of Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda. We are going to read part of that article in this program, overlapping our reading of that with the material that we read into the record in our last broadcast, and we also are going to present some blockbuster supplemental information about the role of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, Al-Qaeda in Egypt and in Libya, and the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi. That attack led to a Republican, I would call it a witch hunt, interrogation for some 11 hours of Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, who then became, of course, the Democratic nominee in 2016. And ultimately, the Benghazi, quote, investigation, unquote, morphed into the investigation of Hillary's emails. And that, of course, factored very heavily in the 2016 campaign. The FBI and James Comey helped tilt things in the direction of Donald Trump with an extraordinary public performance by James Comey in the summer of 2016 when he went into great detail about all of the sins Hillary Clinton supposedly committed with her email, even though there was no criminal activity. That was an extraordinary performance by a police/legal official and was so identified by many expert commentators. And then Comey topped that off about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks before the election. He said that once again they were reopening the investigation into Hillary's emails, once again casting aspersions on Hillary Clinton. And then about a week before the election itself, concluded that there was no wrongdoing. People who are have gotten sucked in by the, quote, Russiagate, unquote, psyop, something we have gone into at great length, should ask themselves whether the FBI is a Russian agency and do they think James Comey is a Russian agent. Again, the Hillary Clinton email scandal and all that implies, a quote scandal, unquote, and all that implies with the calls by Donald Trump for the Russians to hack Hillary Clinton's emails and so forth. The email non-scandal, we could call it, the Benghazi, quote, investigation, unquote, are all outgrowths of the attack on the U.S. Embassy on September 11th of 2012, the anniversary of the September 11th attacks. As we are going to see, there is some very firm evidence that not only were Mohammed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood working with the Al-Qaeda forces that attacked the U.S. Embassy, but in turn, there may, I say may, have been something akin to the October surprise. There are links between Khairat al-Shater, the number two man in the Muslim Brotherhood and someone who wielded great influence within the Morsi government, although he was not an actual official of the Morsi government. Khairat al-Shater also was very close to Al-Qaeda and was reported to have transferred some $50 million from the Muslim Brotherhood to Al-Qaeda. Furthermore, U.S. Ambassador to Egypt Ann Patterson visited with Khairat al-Shater. So did Senator John McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham, two Republican senators. This after al-Shater had been jailed. And bear in mind that al-Shater had no position in the Muslim Brotherhood government. As we will see, there are concrete alleged links, or allegedly concrete links, between Khairat al-Shater and the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi. Given how the attack on Benghazi and the U.S. Embassy basically helped to destabilize the Hillary Clinton campaign and Hillary Clinton herself, it became a major Republican/Fox News talking point, then led directly to the email non-scandal, which had a profound influence on the campaign. Although Hillary Clinton garnered more than 3 million popular votes, not more than, but almost 3 million popular votes more than Donald Trump, roughly 77,000 votes in three key swing states, basically determined the outcome of the election. And the FBI, and in particular James Comey's behavior in that regard, is definitive.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
So we're going to resume with our discussion of the networking between the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and Al-Qaeda, and in turn how that impacts directly on the Benghazi attack on September 11, 2012. We also are going to ruminate further about the corporatist and Republican-style nature of the Muslim Brotherhood. And again, in For the Record program number 733 through 739, recorded in the late winter and early spring of 2011, I voiced my opinion that, in fact, the so-called Arab Spring was one of the color revolutions. Basically, it was a covert operation whose goal was to bring the Muslim Brotherhood and their corporatist economics into power in the Arab world. And as we will see, I think there is also reason to ask whether or not some deal was cut which would keep Al-Qaeda from attacking the U.S., and in turn, Al-Qaeda would receive support from the U.S. for its activities against Syria and possibly also against Russia in the Caucasus. We're also going to take a look at how the U.S. helped to train Arab activists for the so-called Arab Spring, or as I call it, the Muslim Brotherhood Spring. We're going to begin by reading and rereading in some cases and finishing the reading of an article called Exposed, the Muslim Brotherhood Al-Qaeda Connection by Raymond, R-A-Y-M-O-N-D, Ibrahim, capital I-B-R-A-H-I-M as in Mary. This from Raymond Ibrahim, Islam, translated from February 4th of 2014. Now, in this article, there is extensive discussion of networking between the Muslim Brotherhood President of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, and Mohamed al-Zawahiri, the al-Qaeda/Islamist activist and the brother of Ayman al-Zawahiri, who succeeded Osama bin Laden as the head of al-Qaeda. Morsi and Mohamed al-Zawahiri were in telephonic contact, and the newspaper, the Egyptian paper Watan, W-A-T-A-N, had some transcripts of these calls that were intercepted by Egyptian intelligence. And in this, Muhammad al-Zawahiri, again the brother who at one point was imprisoned in Egypt of Ayman al-Zawahiri, is prevailing on Mohamed Morsi, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood president, to implement Sharia in Egypt. And in turn, Mohamed Morsi was courting successfully the political and military support of al-Qaeda. Skipping down into that article, which we read last week, and overlapping the text with what we read last week, the call ended in agreement that al-Qaeda would support the Brotherhood, including its international branches, under the understanding that Morsi would soon implement full Sharia in Egypt. After this, Mohamed Zawahiri and Khairat al-Shatir, that's capital K-H-A-I-R-A-T, and then A-L-capital S-H-A-T-E-R. You will also see it transliterated from the Arabic with two T's. One more time. After this, Mohamed Zawahiri and Khairat al-Shatir, the number two man of the Muslim Brotherhood organization, reportedly met regularly. It is interesting to note here that prior to these revelations, U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson was seen visiting with Khairat al-Shatir, even though he held no position in the Morsi government. And after the ousting and imprisonment of Morsi and other leading Brotherhood members, Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham made it a point to visit the civilian Shatir in his prison cell and urged the Egyptian government to release him one more time. Prior to these revelations, U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson was seen visiting with Khairat al-Shatir, even though he held no position in the Morsi government, and after the ousting and imprisonment of Morsi and leading Brotherhood members, Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham made it a point to visit the civilian Shatir in his prison cell and urged the Egyptian government to release him. The next call, recorded roughly 6 weeks after this last one, again revolved around the theme of solidifying common cooperation between the Egyptian presidency and the Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand, and al-Qaeda and its jihadi offshoots on the other, specifically in the context of creating jihadi cells inside Egypt devoted to protecting the increasingly unpopular Brotherhood-dominated government. As I reported back in December of 2012, Egyptian media were saying that foreign jihadi fighters were appearing in large numbers. One said 3,000 fighters, especially in Sinai. And since the overthrow of the Brotherhood and the military crackdown on its supporters, many of those detained have been exposed speaking non-Egyptian dialects of Arabic. During this same phone call, Zawahiri was also critical of the Morsi government for still not applying Islamic Sharia throughout Egypt, which, as mentioned, was one of the prerequisites for al-Qaeda support. Morsi responded by saying, quote, "We are currently in the stage of consolidating power and need the help of all parties, and we cannot at this time apply the Iranian model or Taliban rule in Egypt, for it is impossible to do so at this moment." In fact, while the Brotherhood has repeatedly declared its aspirations for world domination from its origins, parenthetically, in 1928, the Brotherhood, has always relied on a, quote, gradual, unquote, approach, moving only in stages, with the idea of culminating its full vision only when enough power has been consolidated. In response, Zawahiri told Morsi that, as a show of goodwill, he must, quote, at least release the Mujahideen who were imprisoned during the Mubarak era, as well as all Islamists, as an assurance and pact of cooperation and proof that the old page has turned to a new one, unquote. After that call, and as confirmed by a government source, Morsi received a list from Zawahiri containing the names of the most dangerous terrorists in Egyptian jails, some of whom were on death row due to the enormity of their crimes. In fact, as I reported back in August of 2012, many of the imprisoned terrorists, including Egypt's notorious Islamic Jihad organization, which was once led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, Mohammed Zawahiri's brother, were released from jail under Morsi. One year later, in August of 2013, soon after the removal of Morsi, Egypt's Interior Ministry announced that Egypt, quote, was preparing to cancel any presidential pardons issued during Morsi's era to terrorists or criminals, unquote. During the same call and in the context of pardons, Morsi said he would do his best to facilitate the return of Mohammed's infamous brother and al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri back to Egypt, quote, with his head held high, unquote, in accordance with Islamist wishes, as well as urged the U.S. to release the blind sheikh, unquote, and terrorist mastermind Omar Abdul-Rahman. One more time. During the same call, and in the context of pardons, Morsi said he would do his best to facilitate the return of Mohammed's infamous brother and al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri back to Egypt, quote, with his head held high, unquote, in accordance with Islamist wishes, as well as urged the U.S. to release the blind sheikh and terrorist mastermind Omar Abdul-Rahman. In March of 2013, I wrote about how Morsi, during his Pakistan visit, had reportedly met with Ayman al-Zawahiri and made arrangements to smuggle him back to Sinai. According to a Pakistan source, the meeting was, quote, facilitated by elements of Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, and influential members of the International Organization of the Muslim Brotherhood, unquote. The gist of the next two calls between Morsi and Mohammed Zawahiri was that, so long as the former, meaning Morsi, is president, he would see to it that all released jihadis and al-Qaeda operatives are allowed to move freely throughout Egypt and the Sinai, and that the presidential palace would remain in constant contact with Zawahiri to make sure everything is moving to the satisfaction of both parties. Zawahiri further requested that Morsi allow them to develop training camps in the Sinai in order to support the Brotherhood through trained militants, along with saying that the Brotherhood intended to form a, quote, revolutionary guard, unquote, to protect him against any coup. Morsi added that in return for al-Qaeda's and its affiliates' support, not only would he allow them to have such training camps in the Sinai, but he would facilitate their development and give them four facilities to use along the Egyptian-Libyan border. That Libya is mentioned is interesting. According to a Libyan Arabic report I translated back in June of 2013, those who attacked the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, killing Americans, including Ambassador Chris Stevens, were from jihadi cells that had been formed in Libya through Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood support. Those interrogated named Morsi and other top Brotherhood leadership as accomplices. One more time. According to a Libyan Arabic report I translated back in June of 2013, those who attacked the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, killing Americans, including Ambassador Chris Stevens, were from jihadi cells that had been formed in Libya through Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood support. Those interrogated named Morsi and other top Brotherhood leadership as accomplices. More evidence, and we're going to talk about that, including some that implicates the U.S. administration, has mounted since then. Next, Watan makes several more assertions, all of which are preceded by according to security intelligence agencies, unquote. They are that Morsi did indeed as he promised and that he facilitated the establishment of four jihadi training camps. Morsi was then chief in command of Egypt's armed forces, and through his power of authority, stopped the military from launching any operations, including in the by now al-Qaeda-overrun Sinai. That after Morsi reached Pakistan, he had a one-and-a-half-hour meeting with an associate of Ayman Zawahiri in a hotel and possibly spoke directly with Zawahiri. That after Morsi returned to Egypt from his trip to Pakistan, he issued another list containing the names of 20 more convicted terrorists considered dangerous to the national security of Egypt, giving them all presidential pardons, despite the fact that national security and intelligence strongly recommended that they not be released on grounds of the threat they posed. But the Muslim Brotherhood's international wing, including through the agency of Qayrat al-Shatir, had provided $50 million to al-Qaeda, in part to support the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. One more time. But the Muslim Brotherhood's international wing, including through the agency of Qayrat al-Shatir, had provided $50 million to al-Qaeda in part to support the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. But the Qayrat al-Shatir is the fellow who was networking with U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson and John McCain and Lindsey Graham. One of the longer conversations between Morsi and Zawahiri, reported by Watan, is especially telling of al-Qaeda's enmity for secularist Muslims and Coptic Christians, whose churches, some 80 of which were attacked, burned, and destroyed, some with the al-Qaeda flag furled above them, soon after the ousting of Morsi. I translate portions below. Zawahiri: the teachings of Allah need to be applied and enforced. The secularists have stopped the Islamic Sharia, and the response must be to stop the building of churches. An odd assertion, considering how difficult it already is for Copts to acquire a repair permit for their churches in Egypt. Zawahiri also added that, quote, all those who reject the Sharia must be executed, and all those belonging to the secular media which work to disseminate debauchery and help deviants and Christians to violate the Sharia must be executed, unquote. Morsi reportedly replied, quote, we have taken deterrent measures to combat those few and new legislative measures to limit their media, and in the near future, we will shut down these media stations and launch large Islamic media outlets. We are even planning a big budget from the Brotherhood International Group to launch Islamic and jihadi satellite stations to urge on the jihad. There will be a channel for you and the men of al-Qaeda, and it can be broadcast from Afghanistan. Undeterred, Zawahiri responded by saying, this is a Christian media, and some of the media personnel are paid by the Coptic Church, and they work with those who oppose the Sharia. Secularist forces are allied with Christian forces, among them Nadib Sawiris, the Christian Jew, Morsi. Soon, we will uphold our promises made to you, unquote. In fact, there was a period of time when the secular media in Egypt, which was constantly exposing Brotherhood machinations, were under severe attack by the Brotherhood and Islamists of all stripes. Comedian Bassem Youssef was the tip of the iceberg. In one instance, which I noted back in August of 2012, six major media stations were attacked by Brotherhood supporters, their employees severely beaten. The last call recorded between Mohamed Morsi and Mohamed Zawahiri took place on the dawn of June 30th of 2013, the date of the June 30th revolution that ousted Morsi and the Brotherhood. Morsi made the call to Zawahiri in the presence of Assad al-Sheikh, S-H-E-I-K-H-A, Deputy Chief of Presidential Staff, Rafah al-Tatawi, Chief of Presidential Staff, and his personal security. During this last call, Morsi incited Zawahiri to rise against the Egyptian military in Sinai and asked Zawahiri to compel all jihadi and loyalist elements everywhere to come to the aid of the Muslim Brotherhood and neutralize its opponents. Zawahiri reportedly responded by saying, quote, "We will fight the military and the police, and we will set the Sinai aflame," unquote. True enough, as I reported on July 4th, quoting from an Arabic report, quote, "Al-Qaeda, under the leadership of Muhammad Zawahiri, is currently planning reprisal operations by which to attack the army and the Morsi opposition all around the Republic of Egypt," unquote. The report added that, right before the deposing of Morsi, Zawahiri had been arrested and was being interrogated, only to be ordered released by yet another presidential order, and that he had since fled to the Sinai. Also, on that same first day of the revolution, Kairat al-Shater, deputy leader of the Brotherhood, had a meeting with a delegate of jihadi fighters and reiterated Morsi's request that all jihadis come to the aid of the presidency and the Brotherhood. As Morsi's trial continues, it's only a matter of time before the truth of these allegations and their implications for the U.S. is known. But one thing is certain. Most of them comport incredibly well with incidents and events that took place under Morsi's government.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now, we're going to read another article by Raymond Ibrahim. This is from RaymondIbrahim.com. It's called Behind Benghazi, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Obama Administration, and it is dated August 16th of 2013. I want to note before reading this that coming from an Egyptian perspective, it would be difficult to parse gradations in the U.S. foreign policy. The Obama administration does indeed appear to have carried on a generally pro-Muslim brotherhood orientation, basically in keeping with the corporatist economics that the brotherhood favored and that the transnational corporation favored as well. We have gone into that in For the Record program number 621. I believe that's the number, maybe 620, the mosque in Munich. And even though Obama himself is not a Muslim nor a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, because of the corporatist economics of the Brotherhood, they are favored by the transnational corporations, and those corporations dominate the U.S., just as Mussolini's corporate state was favored by the same elements. Now, in this article, it is very important to note the relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood, the Al-Qaeda assailants of the U.S. Embassy on September 11th of 2012, the 11th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, and Kairat al-Shater, the number two man of the Egyptian, of the International Muslim Brotherhood, and a fellow who reportedly transferred $50 million from the Morsi government to Al-Qaeda. Furthermore, it was Kairat al-Shater who met with U.S. Ambassador to Egypt, Ann Patterson, who may be part of the GOP element of the State Department. She might even be a CIA implant in state. There are plenty of them. Or she may just have been following orders. Perhaps even more importantly, Kairat al-Shater was visited in prison by John McCain, U.S. Republican Senator John McCain, and U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. The attackers of the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi can be credibly identified as associated with A, Mohamed Morsi, and are alleged to have had strong links with Kairat al-Shatir. The passport, or the identification, I should say, the ID of the alleged leader of the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi was found in the home of Kairat al-Shatir, who was networking with Lindsey Graham of the Republican Party, John McCain of the Republican Party, and U.S. Ambassador to Egypt, Ann Patterson. He was the alleged leader of the al-Qaeda attackers who attacked the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi and killed U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens, among others. It was that attack that led to the Benghazi circus in the U.S. Congress, where the Republicans grilled Hillary Clinton for 11 hours, and ultimately the Benghazi brouhaha led directly to the FBI's investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails, and that in turn have a profound effect. The email non-scandal, as I have termed it, had a profound effect on the 2016 election, with the FBI and James Comey performing, as I have indicated. So again, note here the role of Kairat al-Shatir networking with U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson and also John McCain and Lindsey Graham of the Republican Party, and note his relationship to the alleged leader of the attackers on Benghazi. I don't think it takes a lot of extrapolation to see this as something of an October surprise operation, basically, networking between elements of the Republican Party and the U.S. power elite and the corporatist and terrorist elements of al-Qaeda / Muslim Brotherhood. They performed an attack on the U.S. embassy, which led to an investigation and discreditation of Hillary Clinton, which had a huge effect on the 2016 election. Again, from Raymond Ibrahim, 8/16/2013, behind Benghazi, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Obama administration. I would say the U.S. would be a better way of putting this, although the Obama administration basically is like the guy riding the tiger, and it cannot get off. Now, the president does not run the country. He affects it, but ultimately it is the corporations and the intelligence services and the military who run it. This article reads, however, and again, note the Kairat al-Shatir, Benghazi, McCain, Lindsey Graham links here. Evidence that Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood was directly involved in the September 11, 2012 terrorist attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, where Americans, including U.S. Ambassador to Libya Chris Stevens, were killed, continues to mount. First, on June 26th of 2013, I produced and partially translated what purported to be an internal Libyan governmental memo which was leaked and picked up by many Arabic websites. According to this document, the Muslim Brotherhood, including now-ousted President Morsi, played a direct role in the Benghazi consulate attack. Quote, based on confessions derived from some of those arrested at the scene, unquote, asserted the report, six people, quote, all of them Egyptians, unquote, from the jihad group Ansar al-Sharia, or supporters of Islamic law, were arrested. During interrogations, those Egyptian jihadi cell members confessed to very serious and important information concerning the financial sources of the group and the planners of the event and the storming and burning of the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. Among the more prominent figures whose names were mentioned by cell members during confessions were Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, preacher Safwat Haghazi, Saudi businessman Mansour Kadassa, owner of the satellite station Al Nas, Egyptian Sheikh Mohammed Hassan, former presidential candidate Hazim Saleh Abu Ismail. 4 days after this memo appeared, the military-backed June 30th Egyptian revolution took place. Many of the Islamists in the Libyan document have either been arrested, including Safwat Hagazi and Abu Ismail, or have arrest warrants under terrorism charges. By the way, as Muammar Gaddafi warned, if he was cast out of power, it would pave the way for Islamists to hold sway in Libya. And Libya has been involved in a bloodbath ever since then. And the ouster of Gaddafi was accomplished in part with a massive NATO bombing campaign. Continuing. Waleed Shobat followed up with some important investigative work concerning the Libyan document, including by documenting that Western sources had finally acknowledged that there is a group called Ansar al-Sharia operating in Egypt with a cell in Libya, and that with the ouster of Mohamed Morsi, it, along with al-Qaeda, has declared jihad on Egypt's military, not to mention regular civilians in general and Coptic Christians in particular. The fact is, days after the Benghazi attack back in September of 2012, Muslim Brotherhood connections appeared. A video made during the consulate attack records people approaching the beleaguered U.S. compound, and one of them yells to the besiegers, i.e. the jihadis, in an Egyptian dialect, quote, "Don't shoot, Dr. Morsi sent us," unquote. Apparently a reference to the former Islamist president. Most recently, on July 29th of 2013, Ahmed Moussa, a prominent Egyptian political insider and analyst, made several assertions on Tahrir TV that further connected the dots. One more time. Most recently, on July 29th of 2013, Ahmed Moussa, MUSA, a prominent Egyptian political insider and analyst, made several assertions on Tahrir TV that further connected the dots. During his program, while berating U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson for her many pro-Brotherhood policies, policies that have earned her the hate and contempt of millions of Egyptians, Moussa insisted that he had absolute knowledge that the murderer of U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Chris Stevens, was Mohsin al-Azazi, that's capital M-O-H-S-I-N, A-L-A-Z-Z-A-Z-I, whose passport was found in Muslim Brotherhood leader Kairat al-Shatir's home when the latter was arrested. Parenthetically, he's the guy who was networking with Ann Patterson and John McCain and Lindsey Graham, and reportedly the leader of the attackers at Benghazi and the murderer of U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens. His passport was in al-Shatir's home, according to Ahmed Moussa. Continuing, according to the firm assurances of political analyst Moussa, Azazi is currently present in Rabah al-Adawiyah, where he, the seasoned terrorist, is preparing to do what he does best, terrorize Egypt, just as the Brotherhood have promised, in revenge for the ousting of Morsi. But why would Morsi and the Brotherhood attack the consulate in Libya in the first place? The day before the embassy attacks, based on little-known but legitimate Arabic reports, I wrote an article titled "Jihadis Threaten to Burn U.S. Embassy in Cairo," explaining how Islamists, including al-Qaeda, were threatening to attack the U.S. embassy in Cairo unless the notorious Blind Sheikh, an Islamist hero held in prison in the U.S. in connection to the first World Trade Center bombing, was released. That date, September 11th, was also deliberately chosen to attack the embassy to commemorate the, quote, heroic, unquote, September 11th, 2001, al-Qaeda strikes on America. Regardless, the Obama administration, followed by the so-called mainstream media, portrayed the embassy attacks as unplanned reactions to an offensive movie. One more time. Regardless, the Obama administration, followed by the so-called mainstream media, portrayed the embassy attacks as unplanned reactions to an offensive movie. The theory is this. In order to negotiate the release of the Blind Sheikh, the Islamists needed an important American official to barter in exchange. While the violence on U.S. embassies began in Egypt, it seemed logical that kidnapping an American official from neighboring Libya would be less conspicuous than in Egypt, where Egyptians, including Mohamed Morsi, were calling for the release of the Egyptian blind sheikh. In other words, they were going to kidnap the ambassador to hold him as a hostage to swap for the blind sheikh. Thus, the U.S. consulate in Libya was attacked, Chris Stevens kidnapped in the botched attempt. Instead of becoming a valuable hostage, he wound up dead. Add to all this the fact that, despite the very serious charges filed against them, including inciting murder and terrorism and grand treason, the Obama administration, first with Ann Patterson and now with Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham, keep pressuring Egypt to release Brotherhood leaders. McCain personally even visited civilian al-Shater, whose raided home revealed the passport of Azazi, who Musa claims is the murderer of Stevens. One more time. Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham keep pressuring Egypt to release Brotherhood leaders. McCain personally even visited the civilian al-Shater, whose raided home revealed the passport of Azazi, whom Musa claims is the murderer of Stevens. Needless to say, at this point, tens of millions of Egyptians are convinced that U.S. leadership is fully aware of the Brotherhood's connection to Benghazi, and hence desperately pushing for the release of Brotherhood leadership, lest when they are tried in Egypt's courts, all these scandals become common knowledge. Meanwhile, in the U.S., to a mainstream American public, conditioned as it is by a mainstream media, all of the above is just a conspiracy theory, unquote, since surely the U.S. government is transparent with the American people, except, that is, when it is not. Indeed, I think, given how, again, the attack on the U.S. embassy in Benghazi led to the death of Chris Stevens and the congressional circus led by the Republicans, in which they questioned Hillary Clinton for 11 hours, then that led to the email non-scandal, which led to James Comey and the FBI's performance in the 2016 election, and to Donald Trump's calls for the Russians to hack Hillary's emails or to find Hillary's emails and all that has followed. I think the question of the attack on Benghazi as sort of an October surprise type of terrorist treason is front and center. Bear in mind that McCain and Lindsey Graham, as well as U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson, visited Kairat al-Shater. Al-Shater allegedly transferred $50 million from the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood to al-Qaeda. And according to Ahmed Moussa, the passport of Mohsen al-Azazi, the leader of the attackers on Benghazi, was found in Kairat al-Shater's home. And bear in mind that in the recording, one of the attackers yells to the besiegers in an Egyptian dialect, "Don't shoot, Dr. Morsi sent us."
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Some more perspective on why someone like Kairat al-Shater would be endeared to people like John McCain, Lindsey Graham, the transnational corporate community. From Salon.com of January 25th of 2012, we've read this before, by Avi Asher Shapiro, "The GOP Brotherhood of Egypt," unquote. While Western alarmists often depict Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood as a shadowy organization with terrorist ties, the Brotherhood's ideology actually has more in common with America's Republican Party than with Al-Qaeda. I would suggest it has plenty with both. Continuing, few Americans know it, but the Brotherhood is a free market party led by wealthy businessmen whose economic agenda embraces privatization and foreign investment while spurning labor unions and the redistribution of wealth. Like the Republicans in the U.S., the financial interests of the party's leadership of businessmen and professionals diverge sharply from those of its poor, socially conservative followers. Listen to this again. Does this ring familiar? Like the Republicans in the U.S., the financial interests of the party's leadership of businessmen and professionals diverge sharply from those of its poor, socially conservative followers. The Brotherhood, which did not initially support the revolution that began a year ago, reaped its benefits, capturing nearly half the seats in the new parliament, which was seated this week, and vaulting its top leaders into positions of power. Arguably the most powerful man in the Muslim Brotherhood is Khairat al-Shapair, a multi-millionaire tycoon whose financial interests extend into electronics, manufacturing, and retail. This is a guy net worth of with McCain, Lindsey Graham, and U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson, fellow who allegedly transferred $50 million from the Egyptian Brotherhood to Al-Qaeda, and the fellow who allegedly had the passport of the leader of the attackers on Benghazi in his home. Reading again, arguably the most powerful man in the Muslim Brotherhood is Khairat al-Shapair, a multi-millionaire tycoon whose financial interests extend into electronics, manufacturing, and retail. A strong advocate of privatization, al-Shapair is one of a cadre of Muslim Brotherhood businessmen who helped finance the Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party's impressive electoral victory this winter and is now crafting the FJP's economic agenda. At al-Shapair's luxury furniture outlet Istakbal, I-S-T-A-K-B-A-L, a new couch costs about 6,000 Egyptian pounds, or about $1,000 in U.S. currency. In a country where 40% of the population lives on less than $2 a day, Istakbal's clientele is largely limited to Egypt's upper classes. Although the brothers do draw significant support from Egypt's poor and working class, quote, the Brotherhood is a firmly upper middle class organization in its leadership, unquote, Sir Shabi Hamid, a leading Muslim Brotherhood expert at the Brookings Institute in Washington. Not surprisingly, these well-to-do Egyptians are eager to safeguard their economic position in the post-Mubarak Egypt. Despite rising economic inequality and poverty, the Brotherhood does not back radical changes in Egypt's economy. And we're going to conclude with a reading of a section of a excerpt from a remarkable book called Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. It's copyright 2018 by Yasha Levine and published in hardcover by Public Affairs Books of the Hatchet Group. It talks about, many things. It talks about how Eddie Snowden and Jacob Applebaum and many of these so-called privacy advocates are really double agents. It also talks about how they were involved in training for the Arab Spring. We're going to deal with this book at great length in future broadcasts. Note that in For the Record 891 and 895, we spoke about Jacob Applebaum, his work for the Broadcasting Board of Governors, a CIA derivative. He is a devotee of Ayn Rand and the only American WikiLeaker and someone who co-authored a book with Julian Assange. He uses the Tor network developed by U.S. intelligence and basically compromised by it and touts it as secure. We'll talk more about Tor and the Open Technology Fund that we discussed in, for the record, 891 and 895. From Surveillance Valley, within weeks, massive anti-government protests spread to Egypt, Algeria, Oman, Jordan, Libya, and Syria. The Arab Spring had arrived. In Tunisia and Egypt, these protest movements toppled long-standing dictatorships from within. In Libya, opposition forces deposed and savagely killed Muammar Gaddafi, knifing him in the anus after an extensive bombing campaign from NATO forces. In Syria, protests were made with a brutal crackdown from Bashar Assad's government and led to a protracted war that would claim hundreds of thousands of lives and trigger the worst refugee crisis in recent history, pulling in Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel, the CIA, the Russian Air Force, and special operations teams, Al-Qaeda, and ISIL. Arab Spring had turned into a long, bloody winter. The idea that social media could be weaponized against countries and governments deemed hostile to U.S. interests wasn't a surprise. For years, the State Department, in partnership with the Broadcasting Board of Governors and companies like Facebook and Google, have worked to train activists from around the world on how to use Internet tools and social media to organize opposition political movements. Countries in Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America, as well as former Soviet sites like the Ukraine and Belarus, were all on the list. Indeed, the New York Times reported that many of the activists who played leading roles in the Arab Spring, from Egypt to Syria to Yemen, had taken part in these training sessions. Skipping down. The money spent on these programs was minute compared with efforts led by the Pentagon, reported to the New York Times in April of 2011. But as American officials and others look back at the uprisings of the Arab Spring, they are seeing that the U.S. democracy-building campaigns played a bigger role in fomenting protests than was previously known, with key leaders of the movements having been trained by the Americans in campaigning, organizing through new media tools, and monitoring elections. An Egyptian youth political leader who attended the State Department training sessions and then went on to lead protests in Cairo told the New York Times, "We learned how to organize and build coalitions. This certainly helped during the revolution." A different youth activist who had participated in Yemen's uprising was equally enthusiastic about the State Department social media training. Quote, "It helped me very much because I used to think that change takes place only by force and by weapons," unquote. Staff from the U.S. intelligence-financed Tor project played a role in some of these trainings, taking part in a series of Arab blogger sessions in Yemen, Tunisia, Jordan, Lebanon, and Bahrain, where Jacob Applebaum taught opposition activists how to use Tor to get around government censorship. "Today was fantastic, really a fantastic meeting of minds in the Arab world. It's enlightening and humbling to have been invited. I really have to recommend visiting Beirut. Lebanon is an amazing place," Applebaum tweeted after an Arab bloggers training event in 2009, adding, quote, "If you'd like to help Tor, please sign up and translate Tor software into Arabic." Activists later put the skills taught at these training sessions to use during the Arab Spring, routing around Internet blocks that their governments threw up to prevent them from using social media to organize protests. And again, Jacob Applebaum tied to CIA, tied to WikiLeaks, helped apparently Snowden in going from Hawaii to Hong Kong. More about this, however, when we get into the book. I cannot recommend this book strongly enough. It is vitally important. Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. This concludes, for the record, program number 1026, the so-called Arab Spring Revisited, Part 2. This is being recorded on October 2nd of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.